Hi everybody, this is Teresa Chan. I am one of the co-hosts of today's programming. I'm coming in from Hamilton, Ontario in Canada, and I work with Michelle Lin, who is also on today's Google Hangout about the Allium Annals Journal Club. So we're really excited because this is the first time we have two kind of featured faces. We have a set of faces from the Annals of Emergency Medicine editorial crew. And we also have faces from over in Ottawa who are the authors of the paper that we're discussing today. The article that we're talking about is going to be paper by Perry et al., this clinical decision rules to rule out subarachnoid hemorrhage for acute headache. And that was in JAMA of this past year in 2013. And so before we go any further, I'd like to introduce everyone. So first I'm going to introduce Michelle Lin, and she is the brains and the awesomeness behind Academic Life in Emergency Medicine. She's our editor-in-chief there, and she's coming in from San Francisco. So Michelle?
Thank you for joining, and I'm super excited about this as Google Hangout, so watch the magic happen.
Okay. Next, we're going to introduce our folks from Annals. So David, do you want to introduce where you're from, coming from?
Yeah, David Schreiter. Right now I'm in Redondo Beach, California, based at UCLA, and I'm one of the deputy editors at Annals of Emergency Medicine.
Good morning. I'm Tyler Barrett. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. Frigid weather down here at Vanderbilt, and I'm one of the section editors for Annals.
And speaking of frigid cold weather, introducing the Ottawa crew, Drs. Jeff Perry and Ian Steele, who are coming in from super cold Ottawa, Ontario today. Mm-hmm. Because they're a guest of honor, I will introduce them a little bit more. So I'd like to kind of point out that Jeff is one of the, well, the lead author of the paper, and he is one of the emergency physicians at the Ottawa Hospital, and he's an associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine and a senior scientist at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute. And he is a new investigator with CIHR as well, which is the Canadian Institutes for Health Research. So we are really excited to have him. And the gentleman to his right is Dr. Ian Steele, who probably needs very little introduction. But Dr. Steele is a senior scientist at OHRI, so Ottawa Hospital Research Institute, and he's the professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Ottawa. So we're really excited to have them both here. I'd love to kind of kick it off with asking if we could go over the first question. So one of the questions that was supplied to us by the Annals group regarding this paper was one specifically that we chose to discuss because I think it's an important topic. And I know Dr. Steele has some opinions on this, so I'll kick this off with asking the folks from Ottawa if they could chime in a little bit. The question that we had chosen was, how might the patient's location in the emergency department when treated by the clinician affect the evaluation he or she receives?
Sure. So maybe I'll address this issue. I think the question stems from our original derived three rules that was in the BMJ 2010 paper, where two of the rules contained the variable arrival by ambulance. So in the original study, these variables were highly predictive for subarachnoid hemorrhage at our study sites. And in fact, they're what led us to derive three rules rather than just one, which is more customary with clinical decision rules, where we worried that in different geographical or different societal settings, that the trigger for when someone's going to call for an ambulance may be different. As a result of that, we want to ensure that at least one rule did not contain that variable, and we sought to add more sites in our validation cohort that had somewhat different systems and different socio-demographic characteristics so that we could evaluate that further. And as it turned out in our validation paper, we found that the best performing rule was in fact the one without that variable in it. So we suspect that arrival by ambulance can vary between different places. So how does this affect where patients go? Well, in some centers, anyway, the being coming into the emergency department by ambulance may put them into a higher acuity area in the department and may get them seen faster or whatnot, whereas patients that come in through the front door with just a headache who are otherwise well may go to a lower acuity or ambulatory care area. So certainly that does change things, the way that physicians may approach a headache and may change their threshold for investigating them for a serious etiology. However, our rules were certainly validated across the entire emergency department. So we enroll patients that were in resuscitation or the ambulatory care areas of the emergency department. So as long as if someone comes in, they come in with a new severe headache that peaked within an hour, if you apply our rules, it shouldn't matter which geographic location the patient's seeing. You just need to think about subarachnoid hemorrhage, whether or not this patient's at risk, and if so, apply the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule to evaluate them.
Are there any other comments about the first question that anyone else wants to field at all?
I'll just jump in by saying that I think experienced clinicians are aware of the bias that they may have based on the context of where they see the patient. So you take the same patient, say, with chest pain, and they're sitting up cheerfully in an ambulatory area versus the exact same patient in your highest acuity area on a monitor, and you may take the latter one a little more seriously. So this is a framing bias, if you like, that I think we all have to be aware of. And the same could be said exactly for headache patients. And when you see patients in a less urgent area of the department, they could still have something bad.
I think that's a really important point to make. I think that more or less addresses our question too, which was why it's important to talk about this phenomenon to mid-level providers and residents, because I think that bias that you're talking about, that anchoring we have for location and the preference we have for seeing sick patients in sick areas and maybe having a different perception of those patients who are in lower acuity zones being weller, I think those are things that definitely do exist. I'd love to hear from the gentleman from the U.S. as to what do you guys think in your experiences and what you've seen in the literature as well.
I think this was one of the reasons we brought up this question has been addressed by Jeff and Ian specifically, as I'm sure in the U.S. just taking an ambulance alone doesn't necessarily directly correlate with the level of acuity of the patients. I know I have a number of our patients in Nashville who use the ambulance as sort of their taxi service, and then we have some patients who are incredibly sick who will drive themselves in, and you're shocked to hear that they park the car as they're coming across the street with their massive MI or their stroke or you name it. But I think the location of the ED is a huge issue. Having just worked a shift last night where we had a lot of boarding, we're seeing patients in sort of an overflow area. There is a lot of anchoring, as has been addressed, and I think this is a major issue, especially at teaching institutions where we know that residents and interns with less experience may, you know, go ahead and minimize patients who are in sort of a quote-unquote fast track or express care area. And likewise, do the opposite in patients who get put in sort of the trauma bays or the critical resuscitation rooms and figure that patient has to have a full rainbow of labs sent regardless of what their presenting complaint is. So,
all right. So maybe we'll head on to question three, actually, since we've kind of answered question one and two so efficiently. When we're talking about your clinical practice, what information do you provide when counseling patients about the role of the lumbar puncture during a rule-out subarachnoid workup?
Sure. So maybe I'll address this one as well. So once we've identified which patients we're concerned about using the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule or clinical gestalt if you're choosing not to follow the rule, in terms of investigating the patients, we've conducted a previous study, which we published in BMJ in 2011, which looked at the timing of the CT scan, which is typically the first investigation most clinicians will use for investigating patients to rule out subarachnoid hemorrhage. And what we found was if the scan was done within 6 hours, we did find a 100% sensitivity with fairly tight confidence intervals that to identify subarachnoid hemorrhage in the patients who had an early scan. So our recommendations for most patients is that a CT alone, if it's done early, may be sufficient to rule out subarachnoid hemorrhage. Now, when I speak to a patient about this, certainly there are the 95% confidence bands can never be perfect, and subarachnoid hemorrhage is caused by multiple etiologies, can present in different ways, and certainly no rule for subarachnoid hemorrhage will be 100% all the time, and that needs to be understood. However, investigating people endlessly with invasive and expensive tests isn't a rational use of medical resources either, and isn't often good for the patient. I mean, you're inflicting harm, potential complications, and keeping them in the emergency department for much longer when you are performing the lumbar puncture. So when I speak to a patient, their story's worried enough that I'm investigating for subarachnoid hemorrhage, and they presented early enough, and I had a CT scan that was done within 6 hours, and it's negative, then I counsel the patient that their risk is now essentially less than 1%, that the next step, if we were to pursue this, would be a lumbar puncture. I explain what the lumbar puncture is. I explain that if it was myself, I would stop, but that they're the patient, and ultimately they choose to proceed, I'm willing to do so, and usually the conversation stops there. I've only ever had one patient that said, yes, please stick that needle in my back and do that lumbar puncture, and I oblige them, but in general, I think it's sufficient to stop. I would also add in that if I had an extremely high-risk patient, so they're a 50-year-old, they don't have any history of headaches, they had an instantaneously peaking headache, it's just absolute textbook. In that patient, I would counsel that their risk is very low with a negative early CT. However, it's not zero. And I guess I would frame the conversation slightly different in that I would kind of say that their risk is extremely low. It's probably 1% or less, but that I'm still concerned about their clinical presentation. If they want, we can go on to do the lumbar puncture. So it'd be framed slightly different, where I'm not as adamant about ruling it out in that person that's sort of what I like to refer to as an ultra high risk patient, where they really have an exceptional story, maybe lots of family members that have had subarachnoid hemorrhage or whatnot. They're not the average patient where they're at risk, we're worried about subarachnoid enough to investigate, but they're not at that sort of ultra-high-risk patient. And I'd also like to add in that one other thing we've been thinking about recently is the patients that are profoundly anemic, and just making sure that physicians realize that blood does not show up well when patients are profoundly anemic and on any scan. And certainly for when you're looking for subarachnoid hemorrhage, there is fluid there, and if it's iso-dense, you may not see it if the patient's profoundly anemic. So that's one other caveat that we're teaching our residents.
That's a very important clinical pearl, I think. So always get a hemoglobin or a hematocrit just to see and make sure, right?
Yeah, especially if you have somebody with sickle cell or some kind of hemoglobinopathy where they're known to be anemic or certainly at risk of being anemic. For most patients, if they're otherwise healthy and stuff, I'm not so worried about it. You'd have to have a very low hemoglobin, probably in terms of the Canadian units, it'd be less than probably 90 before you kind of be getting into that kind of 80 or 90 before you get into that kind of situation.
Teresa, I wonder, is it okay if I give Jeff a little bit of a hard time here based on some of his comments?
I guess so. Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
So I heard some waffling there on the six-hour rule, which I hadn't heard before. When you combine the six-hour rule, then you're adding on the Ottawa rule on top. So the Ottawa rule has six characteristics, and it's designed such that if you have none of the six, then you're very low risk.
Right? You don't need any imaging.
So you don't even need a CT.
No.
So it's the first time I've heard you say that if you have a number of these factors, that your risk may be high enough that you might wimp out and do the LP anyway, even if the initial CT was done within 6 hours, is a modern third generation, and has been read by somebody with a lot of experience. So can we take it that of the six items that they're somewhat additive if you wanted to, in your mind, calculate low, medium, high, really high risk? So is it true then that if somebody has like four of the six,
yes,
they're very high risk?
Yes, they'd be a lot higher. And I mean, I'd like to clarify, I mean, for 99% of the patients that I see, they're in the 6 hour CT stop would be my counsel to the patient. And for that 1 or 2% of the patients that have almost all of our rules, our risk factors positive, maybe lots of family history of bleeding aneurysms, for that kind of patient, we might go the extra step. Just realizing that while the 6 hour rule point estimate is 100%, there is going to be a very small margin of error, and a person at that extreme high risk may be the one that's going to sort of go into that category. But beyond that, I do not routinely go on to do the LP.
I think that, David, did you have a question? I know Michelle has a question after you, but I know that you had waved a little while ago, so I wanted to check in. David?
Not a question. I just had a comment, which is Jeff was very much sounding like a clinician who's looking at the patient and using all kinds of conscious and unconscious factors to determine what he wants to do in light of some very useful evidence that they created in both the BMJ and the JAMA paper. And it just brings me around to ask then, do we really apply these rules item by item, or do we use them as evidence to kind of target our general gestalt and then use our abilities as clinicians to actually decide which patients get what? I guess that was a question in the end.
David, that was a question I was going to say. Mm-hmm. I might frame something a little bit in that I think as we have more of these decision tools and decision rules that are being generated, and as we get more evidence, as someone who's trained under the era of having some of these rules form my clinical gestalt, it's very interesting for me to come at this, looking at this as a new rule that's been new validated, and compare it to the way that I incorporate much of the Wells criteria, much of the CT head rules criteria. All of those things are kind of built in to what I define as my now clinical gestalt. They've helped build my sense of what it is. So I think, David, your point is really well taken, because I think that in my personal experience, they're very useful for teaching, and I think that they also may be helping form and inform what it is that we put together in our minds when we say this person is low or high risk with our innate gestalt.
I would just jump in and say it. A lot of these rules, whether it be the other Ottawa rules or Canadian rules, were partly designed to be a teaching tool. You know, experienced clinicians often have excellent judgment, but they don't quite know what it is about this patient that tells them that there's no risk that this guy has a C-spine fracture. So it's hard for them to teach that to the nurses or the paramedics or the residents. So it does a way of helping to codify this elusive clinical judgment. We've also studied, and all of my colleagues here in Ottawa have found, that not everybody with experience has good judgment, that they sometimes misclassify people as being much lower risk than they ought to be. So there's something to be hopefully gleaned by even experienced doctors.
Now, that actually brings to mind, there was a paper from the American Journal of Emergency Medicine about System 1 diagnostic reasoning. So that's the Kahneman System 1, System 2, the quick snapshot versus the methodical kind of step-by-step thinking process. And what they found was people are pretty good at deciding whether or not someone could go home, but not much within that spectrum of like the kind of the specific gradients of sick, not sick. So with something like subarachnoid, which is maybe come and gone, it makes it hard for us to do the sick, not sick, because they're not sick when we see them, because it might have happened already, and now they're kind of a little less affected than they were when they were at their worst. So if the person's having the actual hemorrhage in front of you, and they're vomiting, and they have nuchal rigidity, but it's different when it's 16 hours later or 12 hours later, or even like on the cusp of 6 hours later, right? Because they might look much better. So that's kind of an interesting kind of tidbit to look into. That paper is called Sick, Not Sick, Accuracy of System 1 Diagnostic Reasoning, and it's by Wiswell at all from Mayo. So that's kind of just something to bring in since we're on that topic. But Michelle, I know you had a comment.
Yeah, no, this is an excellent discussion. I am coming from the perspective of a clinician and trying to operationalize this stuff, and I know the cutoff is with the six-hour rule, and we are constantly triaging just pages and pages of people who need CT, and people who with a GCS of 15, let's say, whose age is greater than 40, do we do like a code stroke? Do we do a code headache just to get them to the top of the queue of the headache? Of the CT list? I mean, how have you guys addressed that operational process? Or have you, or do you need to?
I guess the most accurate answer is I'm not sure we need to. We are trying to expedite, and we do that, but some research that we're just finishing the number crunching for right now on a sort of sub-study from our combined data sets is certainly indicating that the vast majority of time sort of time from headache onset to CT is actually in the pre-hospital stage. It's the patient deciding when they're going to show up to hospital. The amount of time spent in the hospital from registration or presentation to the emerge to CT, the amount of time savings that you're going to have there appears to be relatively small. And while we will probably save a few people a lumbar puncture by getting them sped through the ED a little bit faster, a lot of it, if we're going to actually be getting people in, maybe more on public education and people knowing to come in sooner, although that may open the floodgate. But it certainly appears to be more the patient-driven than hospital-driven from the initial analysis that we're looking at right now.
I'm going to jump in. Jeff and I work in the same emergency department, but apparently when he works, there's never a waiting time to be seen in the walk-in area, whereas we have bad days where patients wait more than 4 hours just to be seen if they're, triaged to the ambulatory area. And many of us think it is a good idea for the triage nurses to be aware of this rule. And if they see a headache that worries them or tweaks them to the possibility, they should bring it to one of the doctor's attention. I would hate to see them just automatically ordering a CT on everybody with a headache because that is going backwards, but I think they should be alerted to this and bring it to the doctor's attention, and maybe the patient should go ahead.
And I agree with that, and I think that what also we're finding is that that's already been happening at our study sites, and that's probably why there isn't as huge of a difference sort of between the patients with subarachnoid and without, and getting them imaged relatively quickly. The triage nurses already, I think, do recognize when somebody perhaps looks a little sicker or maybe at a higher risk for subarachnoid. I think our rules will help reinforce that, and I think it's good to educate the triage nurses. I think it is good to have a system in the hospital to expedite imaging. However, my point, I guess, is that despite doing all these things, it won't have a massive effect in terms of shifting people, but it may save certainly some of the people that are presenting early enough, may save them the lumbar puncture by streamlining or making our processes efficient. But I agree with Ian, we don't want the triage nurses ordering a CT scan on everyone who presents with a headache, because that's some of these people don't meet our eligibility criteria in the first place and don't necessarily need any investigation for subarachnoid or even consider applying the auto subarachnoid hemorrhage rule. And then for those that are at risk, the auto subarachnoid hemorrhage rule may show that they're at low risk and don't actually need CTing. So I would discourage sort of blanket CTing all headache patients immediately if they hit the door. But as I said, some of this may be not something we can control directly, in that it's patient decisions rather than healthcare decisions that are dictating whether or not they're in the early presenters versus the late presenters.
All right. We're coming up on our 30 minutes, and I'm sure there's a heck of a lot more questions out there, but I don't want to keep everyone here for longer, and we know that the evidence shows that learners and observers probably can't pay attention to us for more than 20 minutes, so we're already 10 minutes overdue. So maybe we can just have everyone, if there's any final thoughts in terms of things that we want to say. Yeah, Tyler?
Teresa, can kind of just ask a quick question to Drs. Perry and Steele, and Dr. Perry just kind of touched on this a little bit with your practice group there being very experienced, sort of already incorporating these rules, but did you all look at how the rule itself compared to the clinical practice, and how many of the subarachnoid hemorrhages were actually missed by the clinicians? I know on the paper in Table 4 you present the kind of the 11 patients that the rules essentially missed, but we're just curious if you specifically looked if there were any patients that would have met the criteria by the rule, but the treating clinician didn't either order the CT or LP, and the patient was sent out. Was that data that you all actually had?
So sorry, just to clarify, so you're wanting to know, were there any patients that were missed by the clinicians on their first presentation to the emergency department?
Right, that theoretically might have been positive for one of the rules that you had, but did not undergo sort of the recommended workup and therefore were misses. Because Table 4 Table 4 seems to report the 11 patients that the rule would have missed. It seems like almost all of them were admitted to the hospital. The clinicians made the right choice, except for the two that turned out not to even be really kind of, you know, true aneurysmal bleeds. So,
in this study, I'd have to go back and check, but I think there were about two patients that were not picked up on their initial visit, were picked up soon after, so with coming back to the emergency department. We didn't pick up anyone. We did 7 and 30-day phone calls, chart reviews to actively look for patients to return to the emergency department. And besides those two that sort of represented, we didn't, certainly by the telephone follow-ups, we didn't identify any further ones, but I believe there's two patients that were initially not picked up by current practice within our study patients during the study period.
Thanks.
And then with the six-hour CT, there were, I believe, three patients that were misread by the emergency physician, sent home. The radiologist looked at later the day or the following day, noticed the subarachnoid, and patients were recalled. Fortunately, none of those patients had any adverse outcomes because of it, just a slightly delayed confirmed diagnosis, but that is, I guess, the one concern where if you have somebody who's not extremely experienced reading the scan, that you may miss small subarachnoid hemorrhages, albeit in our cohorts, all the patients that were in that category actually did well, but there is that small risk.
Okay, so I think that's all the time we have, but thanks everyone for tuning in to the audience, and thanks to everyone for joining us today. We're so lucky to have all of these wonderfully articulate, intelligent people with us on today. Hey, Michelle, what do you think?
Absolutely. No, I appreciate it, and I just wanted to put a final pitch and a final thank you also in that it is tough. There is no perfect research study out there, and I really applaud them kind of being courageous to be open to our relatively unscripted conversation today about their study. I mean, no one's study is perfect except for mine, but, you know, out there it is tough to kind of defend your paper. So, you know, I encourage you to come back on the blog, ask questions, have an engaged conversation as we move forward with this joint journal club. The next one is March on the New England Journal paper on hypothermia and cardiac arrest. So stay tuned for that. Okay. Teresa?
All right. Well, thank you very much for everybody. And again, comment below on the blog or come to the website and comment on the blog if you have comments or questions. And we'll try to sort out more of the answers and how to apply this stuff at the bedside, because I think that's the most important part of why we're doing this journal club. So thank you very much for everything. All right. See you later.